Our is made possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by Euromart International Food Store on Springfield and Locust in Champaign, offering 200 kinds of chocolate, 40 kinds of coffee, and 200 kinds of tea. The Euromart hosts a cheese and olive tasting from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday.
You're tuned to the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. To bring the perpetrators of genocide to justice, investigators must find proof that the victims were non-combatants. This is the work of forensic anthropologists. They work to learn the identities of the victims and how they were killed. On the program today, we talk about this work with a forensic anthropologist, Clea Koff. She was selected to go to Rwanda in 1996. She's also investigated graves in Bosnia, Croatia, and Kosovo. She is the author of The Bone Woman, a forensic anthropologist's search for truth in the mass graves of Rwanda, Bosnia, Croatia, and Kosovo. At the outset of the book, in a chapter titled Before, Koff says, quoting here, "Forensic anthropology is all about before and after. Forensic anthropologists take what is left after a person has died and examine it to deduce what happened before death, both long before and just before, or at the same time. In addition to helping authorities determine the identity of deceased people, forensic anthropology has a role in human rights investigations, because a dead body can incriminate perpetrators who believe they have silenced their victims forever." And that, says Clea Koff, is what drives her. She says doing victims justice is her job and her duty. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon. I look forward to hearing from you, your questions and comments. Here are the telephone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, you can call us toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Clea Koff is the daughter of filmmakers who make documentaries about human rights issues. Her mother is Tanzanian, her father American. They took their two children with them on film projects. So Clea Koff and her brother spent their childhoods in England, Kenya, Tanzania, Somalia, and the U.S. Her book, The Bone Woman, is published by Random House. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Clea Koff, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me here, Celeste.
Did your parents, I wonder, did their interest in human rights issues help lead you to this work?
I think that their interest cannot be discounted, in the sense that my brother and I spent so much time around them as they did work on these independent documentary films. You know, they were interested in colonialism and resistance in Africa. They're interested in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And they never really sat my brother and I down and said, you must also, you know, work towards, you know, these areas where people's voices may be suppressed. I think that we were in that milieu and then we saw their example. And so I think it has to have played a role, although sort of my own interest, I came towards forensic anthropology in particular without anyone else in the family being specifically involved in this area.
Yeah, so what led you to this interest in forensic anthropology?
Well, I did have an interest in bones and, you know, old rocks and dead things, even when I was a kid. And I'm not exactly sure where that comes from. I think that it's partly because my parents didn't allow my brother and I to watch a lot of television when we were young, and so we spent a lot of time outdoors, sort of scratching around in the earth and looking at things. But really, my father actually gave me a book when I was going into my first year of university. He gave me a book called Witnesses from the Grave, The Stories Bones Tell. And that book describes forensic anthropology, what it's all about, the identification of unidentified human remains. But it also talks about the Argentine forensic anthropology team and how it was trying to identify and understand what happened to people who were disappeared during the dictatorship in Argentina in the 1970s and 80s. And really, that book sealed my interest in forensics in particular. That is, I didn't just want to work with unidentified remains. I really wanted to help bring down people who had killed, they believed, with impunity.
Yeah. Forensic anthropology, as I noted that you note, is about before and after. And the book begins with a chapter before, and it concludes with a chapter titled After. And in that chapter, After, you say that it was in front of a classroom in Los Angeles that you made connections that almost overwhelmed you. You say you noticed that when you were talking about Kosovo, you were talking about Rwanda. And when you were talking about the dead, you were talking about the living. And when you were talking about you, you were talking about the people in that room. The connections and the similarities and what was revealed by their differences, that was what almost overwhelmed you. Maybe you would talk with us about the power of those connections and similarities and what they were.
Yes, well, for me, I found that being in places like Rwanda and also in the former Yugoslavia, that is, being in places where the common understanding is that Rwanda, you know, it's in Africa and it suffered a genocide that was, you know, on the basis of ancient tribal conflicts. And in the former Yugoslavia, there was a war that was related to ethnicity. There's a common understanding that these things are very different. And yet, being in the graves, seeing the bodies, it was very clear to me that the stories that were coming out of both of these places were very much the same. The people in the graves were the regular people. The people who were in those graves had been killed because there was an organized attempt to kill them. In other words, it wasn't about spontaneous violence in either of these places. For example, in Bosnia, around Srebrenica, the men and boys that we found in the graves in 1996 and 1997, their hands had been tied behind their backs with wire, and they were still in that position in the graves, and they had been shot to death. Now, I thought to myself, on the one hand, there is the basic fundamental aspect that this is a bad thing, a crime has been committed. But I also had to wonder, how did all this wire get here at a time when most people couldn't organize enough fuel to get a backhoe to even dig a grave? How did that fuel get there? Most people couldn't get flour to make bread. People have been living under siege. Where did this wire come from? And that led me to really question what the stories were behind those conflicts. And I really saw that a lot of the common explanations for why violence has been committed against noncombatants and against civilians in the last decade or two decades has obscured, I think, what are some basic material reasons for that fighting, that there are people who do organize these crimes. There are people that will it to happen, and they co-opt a lot of others into the killing. It is not about people suddenly turning against their neighbor one day because they don't like the look of them. And I think that's important for us to recognize, because otherwise we remain very distant from, I think, our common humanity around the world. We don't focus on the fact that we all seek to live and eat and work and love in more or less the same ways, regardless of religion, ethnicity, culture, and so forth.
Yeah. Have you talked about this with journalists or journalism students?
Not with journalism students per se. I have talked about this with journalists. As you know, the book has really taken me out into this whole other space, because the book has gone out into people's homes and journalists have been asking me questions about it, and we have discussed it. I mean, a lot of journalists, of course, there are media that get to places of conflict long before a forensic team gets there. We get there after the conflict has ended, effectively. And they will be there in the midst. And so they see sometimes more of the complexity of a situation than is even often represented in their newspaper articles, for example.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sometimes maybe it's just a matter of space. They are not given the space to tell the story.
Certainly. I think that is definitely an issue. I think that, you know, even now with what's been happening in Iraq, I often feel that there is no question that most of the time we are getting a very superficial level of the amount of detail, contextualization, and nuanced understanding of anything that is going on in Iraq right now.
Hmm. It's very difficult. It's a very dangerous situation. That's part of the problem there.
Absolutely.
There has been some very fine reporting over the years. I'm thinking of Philip Gurevich's book, We Wish to Inform You, That Tomorrow We Will Be Killed with Our Families. And he talks about some of these same issues that you talk about in The Bone Woman, and that is that there's an element of self-interest in genocide. Then there's also propaganda, and then there has to be conformity.
Exactly. I was very much influenced by what Philip Gurevich has written, and I remember I took with me to Rwanda a very long piece that he had published in The New Yorker, because he gets down to a more individual level at times to describe individual people's experiences within the genocide in Rwanda. And certainly, even now, with the local trials and the Gacaca trials which are going on in Rwanda, which are more like district-level tribunals to investigate people's responsibility for their actions. At times, within the Gacaca, people have described that they've been accused of a crime during the genocide. They didn't do anything, but the person who accused them also owns a chicken feed business, and you know the accused owns a chicken feed business, and that person believes that there is, at the heart of this accusation, really a competition over the resources in that town, you know, over their businesses. I think these are not the only explanations for people's behavior, but I think that they certainly did play a role, and that it has not been about ancient battles or ancient hatreds. In the moment that people made a choice to kill or felt that they were forced to kill, there was something much more immediate and often more material that was in front of them that they were dealing with.
Yeah. Also, it's important to realize that it doesn't start in an instant. It has to be, the flames have to be tended. There has to be kindling there, and then the fire has to be built. And I think this is the metaphor you use. It has to be, the fire has to be stoked.
Yes, I think that it is quite clear, certainly from Rwanda and also in the former Yugoslavia, that there were conditions that were created, there were conditions that were exploited. The propaganda that was used was not useless and airy propaganda. It was very specific and very much tailored to people's real and perceived sense of disenfranchisement. And that is something that is a matter of record. It's not a new concept, although it's something that current propaganda, even about the crimes that took place at those times, were trying to deny.
Hmm. You say in the field, as a forensic anthropologist, you are witness and participant. What do you mean?
Well, certainly as a forensic anthropologist working in the mass graves on behalf of the tribunals, our mandate is to determine who is in the graves, what happened to them, and whether or not they were non-combatants. And when I say who is in the graves, it's often a very basic level of how many men, women, children, and how old they were. And on that level, we interact with the bodies, and so we are a witness to both their death and also something about their lives. And we hope, of course, to also try to identify them and return them to their families if they have any family surviving. And it is at that point when we have actually exhumed a grave, especially one where authorities have said this grave didn't exist, that these people had not been killed but are just missing somewhere. When we exhume those graves, we help to unearth what actually happened in the past. And it is at that moment that families who are dealing with a disappearance begin to deal with the reality of someone's death. And only at that point, I believe, can families look towards these other forms of justice that might happen in a trial or a courtroom. In other words, from what I've read anyway, people do not feel that they can take any solace in a trial until they know what happened to their loved one. In other words, they need to see that connection between the grave and their disappeared relative. And so we do affect people's memory, both of what happened in the past, and then we begin to affect their future as we hopefully actually give back to them the remains of their loved ones.
Yeah, that impact on memory, it's individual, it's within a family, but it's also in the larger community. Maybe you would talk with us about the aspect of this work on collective memory of a community post-conflict.
Yes, well, certainly the exposure of graves, the exposure of the fact that the people in those graves were non-combatants, and they may have even been, for example, in Vukovar, in eastern Croatia. The grave that we exhumed there at Ovčara held the remains of almost 250 men and some women who had been taken out of Vukovar Hospital when that town fell in 1991. Some of the people in that hospital may have been soldiers at one point, but at the time that they became patients in that hospital, they became protected under the Geneva Conventions and under humanitarian law. So for them to be murdered and put in a clandestine grave, first of all, is war crime. It's also a crime against humanity. But the reality was that that crime had been completely denied and covered up. And the grave was very much a clandestine grave and had to be located and found. When we actually exhumed the remains and when the information about what happened to the people inside became known, even those people who had believed the propaganda about these disappearances began to understand that their government may have lied to them. Their government did lie to them in this case. What else have they been lied to about? And so it does affect the whole fabric of a community. And that happens on a local level, but I think it does also affect us on a much more international level as well. It's important to recognize that the things that we often think of as being too awful to happen, you know, this belief that the worst cannot happen, sometimes it does happen, sometimes it has happened, and it's important for all of us to reconcile that, but also to hold those people are responsible, accountable for their actions.
Yeah. Well, the work you and others do in this area is important, and you are clearly devoted to it. How do you deal with the emotional and psychological demands this work makes of you?
It's a good question, Celeste, because I think that when I went into this field, I couldn't imagine what the emotional interaction would be. I was so motivated and interested and focused on working on behalf of the body, I hadn't turned my mind to what it might be like to be in a place where I was interacting with survivors or relatives of the body. And in the book, I get into this issue of what I call double vision, and that's looking at a body and seeing it as evidence, seeing it as a puzzle that I have to solve, and at the same time realizing that that body is somebody's relative. And I really struggled with this over the years. I felt like I spent most of my time with, you know, straddling a line between having my one foot in the camp of just working on behalf of the body and my other foot in the camp of desiring more than anything to give a body back to relatives, because I recognized that their need for the body would go on long after even the trials were over. And I think that the only way I could deal with this emotional pull was to actually keep on working until it got to the stage where the emotions were almost interfering with my work. In other words, I couldn't look at the remains of a man between 70 and 80 years of age who had been shot in the back of the head and the buttocks in Kosovo. I couldn't just look at him and see, okay, I have a report to write. I was looking at him and thinking of someone's grandfather. He had to be someone's grandfather. And that really made it difficult for me to work, and yet I was pleased that I had that emotional connection still, that I didn't at any point become completely turned away. I was always afraid that if I became emotionally upset, I would have to leave the mission, and that would have felt worse to me than anything. I had to stay until I felt my work was done. So I did write in my journal. I talked with a few friends that I developed over the years about these emotional aspects, but in a way I tried to just bottle them up and keep on going.
There are journal entries in this book that you've written, The Bone Woman. What was it like going over these, seeing them, reading over them, then putting them into the context of the narrative that you wrote, that is, The Bone Woman? Was it cathartic? Was it challenging and relieving? What was it like putting this book together?
It was a real mixture. I found that going through the journals, I was really transported to the places I had been, and the memories I have, of course, are intact, but the journals had these details that I might have forgotten. And I really wanted to bring those details forward in the book. I wanted the book to sort of take the reader to look over my shoulder into the graves as I had seen them, but then also to come back out again. And so I wanted the book to have both that immediacy as well as the perspective that I gained over the years, but to really be reminded, you know, closely of particular events or particular bodies in the grave. You know, one man who appeared to be standing up in the grave in Vukovar, where everyone else was actually lying down, and the struggle that I had in trying to actually find the rest of his body, because I didn't understand initially that I was actually working from his head downwards as opposed to sideways. That sort of memory, and going back to that memory, I was surprised actually how strong my emotions were even, you know, now, four, mm-hmm. 6 years later. I remembered things like they were yesterday. And so there were times when I was writing, when I was actually, you know, crying at the computer. And other times, of course, I was laughing out loud at, you know, the funny stories, you know, the things related to my teammates or related to working for the UN. All of that felt very immediate to me. I think a lot of people who do this work, who have gone out on missions, I imagine a lot of people who do any intensive work for one cohesive period of time away from home, it's like anything can transport you there just like that. And that's certainly what the journals do for me.
Yeah. This idea of a double vision is very interesting. Let's talk some more about this. I think that on the one hand, you're so involved in the work and it's satisfying because, you know, I think as you put it in the book, you know, you're going to get the guys who did this, you know, damn it. On the other hand, here you are, you know, in a grave, and you're imagining the life that a person who you're working on their remains, their lives, and it comes through to you in terms of what items they had on them when they died. Jewelry or books or documents, clothing, that kind of thing.
Yes, this aspect of working in the graves and actually uncovering what people have in their pockets, seeing someone's, you know, necklace that they may have done up themselves or their shoelaces which they may have tied themselves before they died, all of that transports you much closer to someone's personality. It goes beyond the anthropological and biological facts that we may know about someone or may be able to learn about someone. And you are very much faced with someone's humanity. Certainly, what I saw in people's pockets in Rwanda, where people had brought the deeds to their houses in their pockets, they had brought their baptismal cards or their children's grade reports from school. These things showed me that at least those people expected to survive. They knew, they had been told they needed to leave their homes, they needed to collect in the soccer stadiums and in the churches for their own safety because some violence was unfolding in the capital. And I think that these documents in their pockets, what it tells us is that they thought, well, my house may be burnt down or I may have to actually move to another town altogether. So I'm going to bring with me the important things that we will need to start life again when all the craziness is over. I think that that's a very powerful statement, in a sense, seeing an expectation to survive and also seeing what was a true lack of understanding of the will that someone else had, that they would indeed be killed. Hmm. There was no understanding of that whatsoever. And that spoke to me very much.
Hmm. Hope and horror living side by side.
Definitely. I think it's a human, it must be a human response that even in the midst of terrible violence, there may be a sense, but there's no desire to give in to that sense that you may not make it.
Hmm. Our guest this afternoon is Clea Koff. She's a forensic anthropologist. She is the author of The Bone Woman, a forensic anthropologist's search for truth in the mass graves of Rwanda, Bosnia, Croatia, and Kosovo. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join the discussion this afternoon. Here are the telephone numbers. Join us with a telephone call in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener in Urbana on line one. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
One of the things that disturbs me about the situation in Iraq is that apparently no effort was made to preserve the grave sites, and that this, to me, seems to present some problems. Would you care to comment?
Yes. There have been some attempts to investigate, at least on a surface level, some of the mass graves in Iraq. There was an immediate situation that unfolded from what I read, that when some military tried to actually close the graves off, there was a situation where Iraqi families who had known maybe for years where their relatives were wanted to actually come to the grave site and look for their relatives. I think that the decision of the military to not actually stand in people's way may have been the right decision, in part because there was no jurisdiction, in a sense, to stop families or relatives from going to the grave sites. At that moment, there was no ongoing criminal investigation of the grave sites. And in fact, the families very much are the beginning point for identification. Without them, forensic scientists don't know how old someone was when they died or how tall they were or what they were wearing. Now, of course, if there is going to be a criminal investigation, one thing that we've seen in the former Yugoslavia and in Rwanda with the tribunals is that it is not necessary to exhume every grave site, especially in a place like Iraq where the killings have been well documented. And in fact, some of the people who dealt with actually burying the bodies have kept all sorts of records about those interments. What can happen is that specific grave sites can be exhumed. Some grave sites can be protected, and they will be representative of the other graves. Now, the families actually exhuming the bodies on their own, all it does is it makes the process of identification somewhat more difficult if forensic scientists are brought in, because there some bodies may actually be commingled, may be joined together. But it can still be done. There can still be some identifications. You can still certainly determine what happened to people. So on the level of the collective voice of the bodies, that will always be there. And so I think that one doesn't have to despair at the idea that the grave sites have been opened by family members. They have a right to be there.
Hmm. Does the listener want to follow up? Caller in Urbana?
Well, it would seem to me that when they went in, they should have already have been planning an investigation, because they their only justification for going in now was the doubtless correct supposition that unspeakable crimes had been committed.
You make a very good point. That would be the logical the logical outcome of invading a place on the basis of a humanitarian argument. Yes, that it would have been logical to have a plan following that to preserve and protect particular grave sites. And again, it would have to be done with the with some interaction with families, so that there can be permissions involved. Because in these cases, of course, a lot of families actually knew where their remains were. These weren't always clandestine or unidentified graves. But your point is logical, and I think that's something that the U.S. government would have to respond to.
Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Urbana on line two. Excuse me, in Champaign. Go ahead.
Yes, good afternoon, and Ms. Cuff, thank you for participating in very healing work. I don't know what else to say. May I ask two questions, Ms. Quinn?
Go ahead.
Number one, Ms. Cuff, you and Ms. Quinn were speaking of communication and propaganda in the media, and that were you involved, and to what extent were you involved in the trial and conviction of the three Rwandan radio journalists that were convicted in Zaire, I believe it was 2 years ago, were you involved in that to any extent?
No, I was not. I worked at 2 to 3 sites in just western Rwanda and also in Kigali that were related to Kibuye in particular and to the Amgar garage in Kigali. So I was not involved with the radio trial.
You heard about them, right? I guess it was the first conviction since Nuremberg, and that's pretty significant in light of, I don't know how you'd say it, the pervasiveness of media and putting forth messages of politics and government these days.
Yes, absolutely. And, of course, with the media trial, there were the media records and the tapes of what had actually been played on the radio. And it was up to the prosecutors to really prove that the propaganda that was on the radio in Rwanda leading up to the genocide didn't just set a tone, but it actually specifically incited people to act to violence.
And there was a quite chilling account. The original indictments are on UN.org, and if you want some chilling reading, you can look at those. And question number two, in your opinion, how prevalent and possibly toxic is the use of depleted uranium in conflicts, especially in the first Persian Gulf War and in the conflicts in the Balkans, given what misinformation we or information we may have not we may have received through the traditional media outlets?
That's an interesting question. I can't answer it fully, although I can tell you that when I was working in Kosovo in 2000, we were about to embark on exhuming one particular site when we were informed that there was a depleted uranium concern at that site. In our attempt to determine how great the concern was and what the actual readings were for depleted uranium, we discovered how difficult it was for even this team of forensic scientists who would actually have to dig in the earth and disturb depleted uranium that may actually be in an airborne particle situation.
Right there.
It was very difficult for us to actually find out what the situation was. We were able to get a hold of one map that showed depleted uranium hotspots throughout Kosovo, and these were coming out of artillery that had been, you know, dropped by NATO forces. So I know that there is a problem with depleted uranium in a lot of areas of the world, and it is very difficult even when you're on the ground to get the information. I don't know if it's considered classified or confidential, but I will say that even for a team that was going into these areas, and this is leaving aside the civilians and other people who live there, it is very difficult to get information even on the ground.
Well, it's quite sad, of course, that the United States military uses that form of output, if you will, as a junkyard for their junk, which is what it comes down to.
Mm.
Thank you for your time, and good day.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Other calls are invited, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Talk with us some more about the dangers of this work. There's the danger for the forensic team of disease. Also, there's a story you tell in the book about finishing your work for the day in Kibawe and coming to dinner and suddenly witnessing an execution.
Yes, well, the execution was in a situation where there were probably reprisal and other killings going on in Rwanda at the time that we were working there. They're quite well documented now, although at that point in early 1996, I had not read of many of those killings. And I think that for me, what was the most difficult aspect, of course, of seeing these two men murdered by machine gun fire in a lake not far from where we were sitting having dinner at the guest house where we were staying, there was obviously this aspect that these two men had been killed. We had witnessed the deaths of two people who, as far as we could see, were unarmed. They were treading water in the lake when they were shot. I had a lot of trouble, even though I'm a forensic scientist who deals with the dead, I had a lot of trouble dealing with seeing someone die. I also was looking at it in the context of the fact that we were a team that was brought together by Physicians for Human Rights on behalf of the United Nations International Criminal Tribunal, and yet we were witnessing some people's rights being violated. We were working every day at a site where we were trying to unearth the evidence of another violation of rights, and yet it was taking place in front of us. And of course, I'm not a war journalist, or I'm not someone who is prepared or in any way trained to deal with ongoing conflict. And so that night, I really had a completely new outlook. Well, I shouldn't say that night. I mean, it has unfolded over the years, this outlook on kind of understanding that human life is something that is, it can be ended with relative ease, especially, you know, when somebody's facing a machine gun, if the person holding the gun, you know, wants it to be that way, that it's a relatively vulnerable situation. And yet it also reminds me of the individual choices that people can make not to kill. Everybody already knows that it's wrong. And then when you go into a conflict or a post-conflict situation, we also have a lot of laws and conventions in place to avoid these sorts of things. In the places where I worked, the forensic teams were not often the targets of particular violence, although we were protected in the former Yugoslavia by mostly American military troops because we happened to be in their areas of Bosnia and in Croatia as well. We were lived with UN military troops. They protected us to and from the grave sites, and then we attempted to also have the grave sites protected because there were and still are people who certainly do not want the evidence from those graves to be brought to light.
Hmm. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana, line 1. Hi.
I was in World War II on the island of Saipan, for example, plus others. And on that island, many deaths occurred, and those were primarily buried in channels made by a bulldozer width, about 4 or 5 feet deep, and just stacked full of bodies, both of Americans and any Japanese that happened to have been in that area. Can you do anything at all about deciphering what occurred in that situation?
Mm-hmm. Yes, there are, in fact, teams who come out of the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology in Washington, D.C., and they have a lab which is based in Hawaii, which is actively attempting to recover and identify the remains of all service people who have been killed in Vietnam, Korea, and certainly from World War II. If the conditions of the grave or interment are optimal, and that is if the bodies have been buried, as you said, to 4 or 5 feet, that's quite good. If the bodies are compressed against each other and then were covered up before there was a lot of flies laying eggs and so forth on the bodies, there is a very good chance that not only will you find certainly skeletal remains, but you may also find hair and remains of clothing. All of that, together with records that may have been kept, can help one to identify individual people and certainly what happened to people.
Okay, I think the call has bounced off. So thank you for the answer. Thank you for the question. Very interesting question. This is the Afternoon Magazine. We've got about 5 minutes left in this portion of the program. Our guest this afternoon is Clea Koff, author of The Bone Woman, a forensic anthropologist's search for truth in the mass graves of Rwanda, Bosnia, Croatia, and Kosovo. Being on the ground as part of a forensic team, does it serve to, while you're doing the work there, does it serve to make a statement that these crimes will not go unpunished? That, you know, do you understand what I'm asking?
Yes, I mean, I think I do. I think that it's very important that there is, first of all, a statement about what has happened to people who can no longer essentially speak for themselves. I think on a very basic level that there is an aspect of dignity that needs to be restored. Then when you look at what we, you know, we talk about war crimes and crimes against humanity, when you look at things on the individual level of murder, I think that it is very important that there is an attempt towards accountability. Now, that accountability can come in many different forms. It does not always have to be through a trial. It could be through a truth and reconciliation process, as we've seen in South Africa, or a mixed truth and reconciliation and tribunal process, as is undergoing in Sierra Leone. Or it can be a local or a district trial. What I think is important about this issue of accountability is that murders and mass murders have taken place in the countries where I have worked. They took place before, in the 50s or in the 70s, at different times. And at those times, nobody was held accountable. And in fact, no statements were even made recognizing what was going on at the time in the international sphere, let alone within the countries themselves. And there's someone who's written a wonderful book, Samantha Power, talks about this continuum of intervention, which is that even while killings are unfolding, before there is a military intervention, per se, by UN troops, you can have statements that condemn the activities of a government or a military. You can have sanctions. You can have the closing of embassies. I think that all of that is very important. Of course, when a forensic team comes on the scene, you're coming in after the crimes mm-hmm. have been committed. And I think it still is important to attempt to, it goes towards accountability, because one thing I know for sure is that sadly and terribly, you cannot bring people back. That is, for me, the hardest part about my work that was not difficult at the beginning, but somehow became more difficult. I had a desire to bring people back because I could see that their deaths did not need to happen. So I think it's really important to give some respect around that terrible situation.
Mm. So it's important for the survivors, and it's an important concrete visual statement that people are on the ground investigating what happened.
Yes, I believe so. And of course, you know, this is within a larger context of communication about what has gone on during a war or conflict. And again, I'm speaking very specifically about conflicts that involve the deaths of non-combatants, because I am anti-war in a sense, in the most broad sense, but I do believe that when a war is underway, there are legitimate targets. And I shouldn't say I believe that. I recognize that that is how the laws are arranged. There are legitimate targets. Civilians, non-combatants, are not legitimate targets. If a war is raging around us, we should be able to tend our vegetable gardens if we are civilians. I know, you know, that's a silly example, but really that's what the laws say. And so I think that's important it is important that when civilians are killed in a war or a conflict situation, we need to know why. Why is this happening? It should not be happening.
Mm. What are you at work on today? I mean, now you've written the book and you've been out talking about the book. Very important. Will you continue to work with the UN and in this kind of work?
What I'm hoping to do is to actually open an agency in the U.S. which helps families that have missing adults, liaise with the coroner's offices, which have a backlog of unidentified bodies of adults. It's often very difficult for families to get the full attention that they need because it's not illegal for an adult to go missing. But, of course, some adults are just 18 or 19-year-old college students. Meanwhile, these unidentified bodies are sitting in the freezers of the coroner's offices, or they're being cremated and put in paupers' graves without an identification. And I believe that there are some areas of disconnect between missing persons reports and the information we actually learn from a body itself. And so I'm hoping that this agency can really sort of sit between these two groups to improve the information that we can actually get from families to identify a body and get it to the coroner's officers, which are already doing a full anthropological analysis. I've seen that families who are missing a relative here in the States, their emotions and their grief and their inability to move forward in their own lives fully is very much the same as even what people are experiencing, say, in Bosnia, in Srebrenica, the women who are looking for their husbands and fathers and brothers who went missing in 1995 and haven't been seen since.
Hmm. Thank you for talking with us, and thank you for doing the work that you do.
Thank you so much for talking with me, Celeste.
Clea Koff has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She's the author of The Bone Woman, A Forensic Anthropologist's Search for Truth in the Mass Graves of Rwanda, Bosnia, Croatia, and Kosovo. The book is published by Random House. 8 minutes before 2 o'clock, Dave Dickey is standing by with settlement prices from the Board of Trade.
Indeed I am, Celeste, and good afternoon, everyone. It was another difficult day in the soybean pit at the Chicago Board of Trade. Weather concerns and activity from the funds drove the July contract all the way down to 801 before it finished the day at 806. We'll get to the specifics of the soybean pit in just a second. First, let's touch on the wheat. July, a high on the day for the wheat contract, a 375, a low of 366 and a quarter, settling 367 and a quarter, down 7 3/4. September, a high of 383, a low of 375 and a half, settling 376 and a quarter, down 8. December, a high of 394, a low of 385 and a half, settling 386, down 8 3/4. March, a high of $4, a low of 393 and a half, settling 394, down 8. May, a high of 397, a low of 397, settling 397, down 7. I don't think that contract actually traded today. July corn, a high of 316 and a half, a low of 310, settling 310 3/4, down 11. September, a high of 314 and a half, a low of 309 and a half, settling 310 3/4, down 9. December, a high of 314 and a half, a low of 309, settling 310, down 9 1/4. March, a high of 317 and a half, a low of 313, settling 313 and a half, down 9. May, a high of 320, a low of 315 and a half, settling 316 3/4, down 8 3/4. In July, a high of 320, a low of 315 and a half, settling 316, down 8 1/2 on the day. July oats, a high of 149 and a quarter, a low of 143 3/4, settling 146 3/4, down 5. September, a high of 155 1/2, a low of 150 1/4, settling 152 3/4, down 4 1/4. July soybeans, a high of 833, a low of 801, settling 806, down 43 1/2. August, a high of 808, a low of 773, settling 780 1/2, down 37 3/4. September, a high of 735, a low of 711, settling 718 1/2, down 37. November, a high of 702, a low of 678, settling 687 1/2, down 31 3/4. January, a high of 703, a low of 681, settling 688, down 33 3/4. March, a high of 701, a low of 680, settling 687, down 33. July soybean meal, a high of 259.50, a low of 250.70, settling 254.50, down 11.70. August, a high of 255, a low of 245, settling 247.80, down 12.70. July soybean oil, a high of 28.40, a low of 27.60, settling 27.90, that was down 106. And August, a high of 28, a low of 27.20, settling 27.54, down 103. The settlement prices are also in over on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. And unlike the board, Celeste, where there was an awful lot of red today, there was some green on that board today over on the Merc. And looks like lean hogs had a particularly good day.
Yeah, lean hogs, June and July finished limit up. And August, lean hogs finished almost limit up. Cattle also higher today. Let's take a look at the numbers now. August feeder cattle, the high 108.50, the low 107.20, the settlement 108.07.5, that up 90. September feeder cattle, 106.90 the high, 105.60 the low, 106.70 the settlement, that up $1. October feeder cattle, 105.90 the high, 104.80 the low, 105.70 the settlement, that up 107.5. June live cattle, 90.30 the high, 89.20 the low, 89.67.5 the settlement, that up 47.5. August live cattle, 90.92.5 the high, 89.65 the low, 89.90 the settlement, that finished down 2.5 cents. June lean hogs, today's high, 78.37.5 the low, 77.20 the settlement, 78.37.5 that finishing limit up $2. July lean hogs, 77.75 the high, 76.90 the low, 77.75 the settlement, that up the limit up $2. August lean hog, 77.32.5 the high, 76 even the low, 77.27.5 the settlement, that up 195. October lean hogs, 64.50 the high, 62.67.5 the low, the settlement 64.20, that up 157.5. July pork bellies, 117.45 the high, 115.70 the low, finishing in the middle at 116.90, that up 97.5. Let's take a look now at what's happening on Wall Street. The Dow is down 31 points at 10,233. The NASDAQ is off 18 points at 1971. And the S&P 500 down 5 at 1120.
Programs on WILL are made possible in part by a grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom design, gemstone round tables, and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Rebecca Schwartz from Putney, Vermont writes, Dear Dr. Science, I bought a 28.8 modem to access AOL, but the pages don't seem to download any faster. Should I get a faster computer?
Of course you should. So many of our personal problems would be solved if only we had a faster clock, more memory, and the love of a good man or woman. You can buy all three, but they don't last. Within a couple of years, your CPU chip will be hopelessly out of date. You won't have enough memory to run the latest software, and that trial separation will have turned into the real thing. That's why I've stuck with my TRS-80. Keeps me focused on process rather than technology. Sure, I remember the rush of excitement when I upgraded from my Commodore 64, but that rush didn't last either. No, within weeks, I was taking my TRS-80 for granted. Just human nature.
Thank you, Dr. Science.